Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Right now, on Last Call, is the AI trade still rocking? NVIDIA's Jensen Huang speaks out to CNBC. Dan Ives here with reaction. Bullseye, Robinhood earnings moving big on results. The CEO will join us at a first on CNBC interview. Breaking tonight, a big development in the streaming video wars. We'll have the new developments. Withdrawn, AstraZeneca making an eye-opening move on its COVID vaccine. This story deserves a lot more attention than it's getting. Plus, a truly rare market event that hasn't happened in 7 years. Till today, we'll tell you what it is. And gunning it in reverse, are Mercedes souring on one of its biggest goals yet? All that and more over the hour. Belly up or buckle up for the Golden State. Last Call is up right now. Hi, everybody. I am Brian Sullivan, live at our Los Angeles Bureau for the rest of the week. All right, we've got all that ahead. But first up, what AI, the world's biggest company, and 20,000 or so votes that could determine the next president have in common? Microsoft announcing a major investment in artificial intelligence, and it's in the key election state of Wisconsin. But not only that, it's right near or basically on the same property as the failed Foxconn investment from the Trump presidency. So President Biden flew out there today and was on the scene with Microsoft President Brad Smith. They spoke about that project earlier today.
Microsoft, as the president already pointed out, is investing $3.3 billion to build a new data center here in Racine. That's going to help operate one of the most powerful artificial intelligence systems in the world.
More than anything, this project is about using the power of AI to fuel the future of manufacturing companies and jobs and skills across the state of Wisconsin and around the country.
Now, this was a good PR move by the president because the federal government and your tax dollars really have nothing to do with this at all. We aren't aware of any federal money going to this project. I mean, why should it be? Microsoft is one of the richest companies in the world. Still, it is being politicized, pretty much like everything else these days. But even with the president making a few statements you heard on camera, are these types of things working for President Biden? Well, it does not appear so, not our opinion. According to a new poll from Politico, most voters don't know about many of the White House's big spending projects. Example, the CHIPS and Science Act. Nearly 7 out of every 10 Americans knows little or nothing about it. Same with the big infrastructure spending plan, with over half of Americans not knowing much or anything about the $500 billion plan. Now, of course, this could all speak more to the American electorate than anything else, but I think, dear viewer and listener, you get the point. The road to the White House, of course, runs right through Wisconsin. Remember, despite being up 10% in the final state polls there in 2020, President Biden won the state by just 20,682 votes, a tiny margin. And today, a new poll from Quinnipiac shows the race is razor tight, with Biden and Trump basically tied when you factor in third-party candidates. Factor them out, President Biden is indeed up a little. But given the billions he is throwing at the state, should the polls even be this close? Let's talk more about that and the business of the election. And bring in our first up panel tonight, Forward Party co-chair Andrew Yang and People's Corporation chairman and CEO Don Peoples. Don, you're partly in the marketing business, all right? You do these big new projects. You want people to know that it's you and the People's Corporation behind them. How does President Biden start to get some credit from these projects when that Politico survey showed most people aren't even aware?
Well, I think the challenge is that the communication between the White House and the states that he's operating in are not in sync. And so the general public is not aware of many of the investments that the federal government's making and his team is not doing a good job of it. Also, I just think that many voters have written off President Biden. And I think that's one of the things that is a headwind for him. And I think he'll continue to see that because what? I think.
What do you mean by that, Don? Written him off?
Well, I think that a large number of voters, a majority, a supermajority of voters, do not believe he's prepared or capable of serving in another term, that he doesn't have the stamina or the mental faculties to be able to run the country. And so it's very hard for him to overcome that. No matter what the government does, no matter what the incentives are, they look at him as less capable than Donald Trump. And so they have to make a decision. Do they go with someone they deem less capable, but they like better? Or do they go with someone that they believe is more capable to serve in the office? And I think that's where the election is going to boil down to, is those issues.
Yeah, and you know, again, Andrew, it's tough. And he had another prompter gaffe and a story that apparently was not accurate about football. That aside, I mean, do you think that, or maybe not, does that take away from these moments, Andrew, when, you know, you come out, it's a huge project. I'm a part-time Wisconsin resident. I love the state. I'm very happy they're getting this investment. But then you got these overhangs of other things like a prompter gaffe or a story that's not accurate about the Green Bay Packers. Does that overshadow these projects? And if you're his team, how do you prevent this? How do you keep that positive PR going?
I think the Biden team was wise to retire the Bidenomics term and argument. And when you talk about the economy, I could say $3 billion in investment in this plant, a couple thousand manufacturing jobs, but those things are abstract to most Wisconsinites and most Americans. The way most Americans experience the economy is when they buy groceries or buy gas. And on those levels, Joe Biden, unfortunately, has inherited a set of issues that most Americans still feel very troubled by day to day. I think that's one reason why the headwinds that Don describes are there for him on the economy, because the numbers show that Donald Trump is ahead on the economy among independents over Joe Biden in terms of confidence.
Yeah, Andrew, I think you nailed it. You know, and again, I've been to this facility that was supposed to be Foxconn. It never happened. There's like this weird glass sphere there and a small power plant, and that's pretty much it. Something's going in there that's good. But I think, Andrew, to your point, if you're a Wisconsin voter and you're paying $40 to feed your family at a fast food restaurant, and you're paying $25 a couple of years ago, that's what you care about. You don't care about this potential new Microsoft plant years down the road.
That's exactly right. The truth is that the way we're experiencing the economy is increasingly politicized and polarized also, where you can see the satisfaction of the economy dovetailing with how you feel about the party in office. It also has to do with the relationship with the press, where 69% of Democrats have a high confidence in the press and thus implicitly the numbers that are being reported. And only 25% of Republicans do. Among independents, who I think are going to be the key voting block, that number is 39%. So can you translate it to lived experience, and can you convey the message in a venue that will actually generate trust and attention in a press environment where some people have tuned out certain channels?
Yeah, it is tough, Don. I mean, listen, to that point, I can assure you that many colleagues of mine in the press, whatever their political leanings, are frustrated with the White House because the president basically does not give interviews. And if he does, it's very tightly controlled. You've got to get the president out there, right? If you're his team and you want to counter some of the things that you just talked about, okay, that you just said, and you're accurate on them, Don, because I talk to people everywhere of all political persuasions. You've got to get the president out there. He's got to be live, unscripted interviews, presidential debates, and put some of those concerns to rest. Do you not?
You would if it were another candidate. But Joe Biden is not that candidate to be able to go out and do that unscripted. In fact, 20 years ago, unscripted Joe Biden all caused difficulty. So I don't
that's
think that's the
point.
I think there's another issue here that we're not focusing on, and that is African-American voters are leaving President Biden. And the reason they are is just what Andrew just articulated. They're hit by high gas prices, inflation, and then, of course, the cost to own a home has more than doubled. And rents have gone up in most of the major cities around the country. And so Americans in general are feeling the pain in their pocketbook every day in their everyday lives. But African Americans felt that they brought him to the White House. And then here he's in the White House and done very little to improve the quality of their lives. And so I think they are looking at an alternative. And that is why Donald Trump is polling over 30% with African-American voters. He's going to do very well with African-American men, and he's beginning to move African-American women. Yeah. With those numbers, it would be impossible for Biden to win.
And if people interview Trump, if it was me, I would ask him, what are you going to do about inflation? I don't know what he can do about inflation either. Don Peebles, Andrew Yang, both Democrats or centrist Democrats, libertarians, and you guys are saying it, not us. This is a big deal. Andrew Yang, Don Peebles, thank you both very much. All right, now to the markets and your money. And it was a mixed day. The Dow was up a little, but, you know, listen, kept this little rally rolling. The Dow is actually up 3% this month. But check this out. This is what's kind of cool. The S&P 500 doing something rare. It was, on a percentage basis, effectively completely unchanged. 0.0%, basically like Plutarski's GPA. Now, to be exact, the S&P 500 closed down 0.000578%. That, according to our friends at Bespoke, the smallest daily change for the S&P 500 in more than 7 years. You got to go back to January 10th, 2017, when it actually finished exactly unchanged. 0.00. We're going to call that our little RBI for you today. You're welcome. All right, let's get a quick check on the futures market as well. Unchanged there, not a lot of action. Inside the market, your big winner of the day, Vistra, the Texas-based power company, enjoying a strong first day as a new component of the S&P 500. Vistra, which used to be known as TXU, it's part of Calpine, remember them? One of the best performing stocks in America this year. The biggest decliner in the market, Uber, down almost 6% after posting a surprise loss. All right, we are just getting going. We've got much more to come from LA on deck. Stream this. A big announcement just out from two Hollywood giants. We'll have the breaking developments next. And later on, Robinhood does something it has never done before. And the CEO is here with it first on CNBC Interview. Stick around.
Experience the joy of running in the new Triumph 22 from Saucony, the original running brand. Stacked with luxury foam cushioning, Triumph 22 turns miles into smiles with the ultimate blend of comfort and energy return. Shop Triumph 22 at Saucony.com. That's S-A-U-C-O-N-Y.com.
Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
All right, time for Tomorrow's News Tonight, and we are here in Hollywood, so this is very appropriate breaking news. Disney and Warner Brothers are teaming up. They're going to offer you a new streaming video bundle this summer. Julia Boorstin, whose house we're in, joining us now. Julia, what will this bundle look like?
Well, Brian, here's what we know. The new streaming bundle is coming from Disney and Warner Brothers Discovery. So it's going to be a bundle of Disney Plus, Hulu, and Max. They will be offered together. Now, we have just a few details. This bundle is set to launch sometime this summer. It will be available for purchase on any of the three streaming platforms' websites, offered as either an ad-supported or an ad-free plan. Now, we don't have any details on pricing yet, but presumably these bundles will be cheaper than paying for Max combined with the current Hulu Disney Plus options that you can subscribe to. Now, Disney Entertainment's president of direct-to-consumer Joe Early saying that this partnership, quote, puts subscribers first, giving them access to blockbuster films, originals, and three massive libraries featuring the very best brands and entertainment in streaming today. Warner Brothers Discovery CEO of Global Streaming and Games, J.B. Perrette, saying that this new offering, quote, will help drive incremental subscribers and much stronger retention. Now, I have to say this is not entirely a surprise because David Zaslav has said he thinks bundling is a great solution to streaming challenges. But, Brian, there are certainly some key details we are waiting to learn. Warner Brothers Discovery earnings are tomorrow morning, so we'll see what David Zaslav says then.
Yeah, well, and we'll see, Julia, if there's any earnings in the earnings. All right, Julia, stay with us. Let's also bring in CNBC.com media reporter Alex Sherman. Alex, okay, make it make sense, my man. You've got this new streaming bundle. My God, it's starting to sound a lot like cable.
Yeah, look, this is the great rebundling, right? The age is finally upon us. This has been spoken about for at least a year, if not more at this point, with lots of media companies talking to each other about what the right combination of bundle should be. We're finally seeing one. We've seen it a little bit on the margins. Actually, Verizon has offered a variety of different bundles for even more than a year now. But that has been limited to new Verizon customers, and you have to subscribe to a certain plan. This is really the first one where we're seeing one major media company partner with another major media company, putting their two flagship streaming services together, or in this case, three, with Disney Plus, Hulu, and Max, all coming together for a discounted price. But you'd have to imagine this is just the starting gun for more bundles. It's sort of an opening the door of other media companies deciding, okay, it's now okay for us to come together and offer these stronger partnerships by offering a discount just like cable.
Is this, Julia, is Warner Brothers Discovery, you know, and Disney, Ila, Zaslav, Iger, is that a strange bedfellow to you?
Well, look, I think they're just making partnerships. These are companies that have always been both competitors and also partners, because remember that every single one of the media companies has a studio that is in partnership with other studios. So, for instance, you know, Comcast, CNBC's parent company, has distributors. So Comcast, makes deals with all of these media companies. But then you also have the fact that a lot of these companies have studios, like Warner Brothers has a studio that sells its TV shows to air on all sorts of different networks. So these companies are always in partnership. They're always in conversation. I think them bundling these services is not a surprise, because you have to think about the fact that they've always figured out how to take their content and sell them to each other's platforms. This is just an attempt to try to minimize churn and lock in consumers the way the old TV bundle used to lock in consumers.
Just to dovetail off what Julia just said, remember, there's this new sports bundle that includes both of these two companies, Warner Brothers Discovery and Disney, also Fox. That's going to launch in the fall. So we may end up seeing, though we don't know it yet, some sort of double bundle. You could at least conceivably see this sports bundle being bundled with some bundle of Max, Disney Plus, and Hulu, because those are complementary products. So we're definitely seeing the different media companies kind of pair up and try to figure out partnerships to best serve their overall audience.
It's like home and auto insurance, the bundle. I can't keep it all the bundle, the bundle, the bundling, and the bundle. I mean, at some point, we're just going to go back to say, screw it. I'm going to use my cable box because everything is there where I need it. The voice remote works. Anyway, guys, I want to both ask you about a story just out of the New York Times. It's got new details on Sony and Apollo's bid for Paramount. Evidently, they want to break it up, all of it, selling the assets off. Like CBS would go one way, MTV would go another way, Paramount Plus, Paramount would go another way. Julia, what do you think? I mean, is that carving it up and selling it off probably what's going to happen?
Yeah, that's absolutely what I've heard from my sources. What we know right now is that this Apollo Sony deal is very different from the Skydance deal, because the Skydance deal and that offer to Sherry Redstone was about keeping these assets together. And Sherry Redstone seems to very much care to keep the assets together that are part of this company that her father built. In contrast, the very nature of the offer from Apollo, you know, from the private equity side and from Sony, is the idea that some of these assets are more valuable to them and than others. For instance, the studio is really the key piece of this and what would be combined with Sony. And then you have other pieces like CBS, which are more naturally sort of equipped to be sold off or separated. And then I think Paramount Plus is another question where that one goes.
Yeah, still every day. By the way, dinner last night is all anybody could talk about. Julia Boorstin, Alex Sherman, thank you both very much. All right, up next, is the AI trade alive and well? NVIDIA CEO gives some must-hear comments to CNBC. Plus, the FTX bankruptcy story just got weirder, a lot weirder, and Bankman-Fried must be rolling over in his cell. That story next.
Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones, from powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY, a big idea that inspired the world to invest differently, and still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
All right, that's right, folks. We got a bonus TNT for you. Shares of trader favorite Arm Holdings are getting hit right now. They're down just under 10%. They had a relatively lukewarm sales forecast. And once again, whenever anything like this happens, it raises concern that the AI spending spree may be slowing down. Remember, back in 2020, NVIDIA CEO Jensen Huang tried to buy Arm, but the $40 billion deal was shut down by regulators, saying the merger, any merger, would hurt competition and drive up semiconductor prices. Huang spoke about Arm and the AI revolution in an exclusive interview with our own John Fort.
Look, we're going through the single greatest platform shift in the computer history. You know, computing hasn't really changed since the IBM System 360 invented central processing units. And now we're going through two at the same time, accelerated computing from central processing units to generative AI, completely revolutionizing how software is done and what software can do. And so we're going through that incredible platform shift. Lots and lots of opportunities, of course. But I got to tell you, I love ARM then. I love ARM to this day. And everybody now realize what a great franchise it is.
It's a love fest. There you have it. Jensen loves ARM and his high hopes for AI. The question is the broader AI trade alive and well and worth your money? Let's bring in our friend, Wedbush Securities Managing Director, Dan Ives. Dan, I'm assuming, I'm just throwing this out, you will say that the AI trade is alive and well, but is it topped out?
I think the AI revolution's just started. I mean, you heard there, godfather of AI, Jensen, and now that tidal wave, that $1 trillion of spend, it's coming to the rest of tech. You look at ARM, you look at Microsoft, now we see what's happening with Alphabet and others. That's why I believe this is just the early stages of a fourth industrial revolution playing out, being led by the godfather of AI, Jensen, NVIDIA.
But when you get an ARM, which, you know, has a slightly lukewarm revenue forecast and it falls just under 10%, I mean, traders, how do you soothe jumpy traders?
Yeah, and I think that's really been the difficulty in this market. I mean, if you get ARM, that's a robust forecast and they crush those numbers. I think you got to navigate the volatility and see far through the trees. And we've seen similar things on Microsoft and a lot of other names in terms of knee-jerk reactions. But if you look at where the spending is, and that's what it comes down to, the demand. This demand is unlike anything we've seen since 1995, star of the internet, not 1999, which is why I believe this red, the second, third, fourth derivative, it's a get out the popcorn moment. It's just starting to play out across software and semis.
All right, I want to shift gears, theoretically, get your thoughts on Tesla. Chinese state media, Dan, reporting Tesla is proposing rolling out its robo-taxis in China. Of course, this comes after Elon Musk made a surprise visit a couple weeks ago to Beijing, where he met with the Chinese premier. Assuming it happens, how important, if at all, is China to Tesla's robo-taxi push?
Look, China, in my opinion, is the heart and lungs of the Tesla growth story. And if you look at FSD, robo-taxis, this is the first step to ultimately what we view as FSD and autonomous in China for Tesla and Musk. And it would be a historical moment. And I think for the Tesla story, obviously navigating challenges the next few quarters, but the golden goose is autonomous and FSD, and China plays a key role there. This is a major shift to what I think we've seen over the last 6 to 9 months. Musk continues to play well in that sandbox in Beijing.
Dan Ives, also out west. And Dan, CNBC has hats that you can borrow. We're going to give you a hat. You're out west. I'm going to be your mother right now. We got to worry about the sun. You know what I mean? Be careful out there. We're going to give Dan Ives a CNBC hat. In the meantime, the FTX bankruptcy story just took a fairly bizarre new turn. It's a little complicated, but trust us, you will be interested. The headline is that the FTX estate is proposing a plan that will recoup lost funds for nearly all creditors to the massive crypto bankruptcy. Now, that sounds like good news, right? But many people owed money by FTX are actually not happy. One of them is probably named Tom Brady. Joining us now is CNBC's Mackenzie Sigalos. Mackenzie, all right, a bankruptcy, all the money and more is going to be recovered. Why are people unhappy?
So, Brian, the main problem here is that the bankruptcy estate froze the value of customer crypto assets back in November of 2022. So we're talking about the bottom of the bear market. Bitcoin was trading at around $17,000. It's up 270% since then, which means that even though 98% of customers are apparently getting their money back plus interest, they're getting a fraction of what their tokens are actually worth at market prices today. I mean, like, if you do the math, Bitcoin was trading at $17,043 on the day that FTX filed for bankruptcy. If you own just one Bitcoin that day under this proposed bankruptcy plan, you'd get 118% of that back. That's 20K. And today, Bitcoin's trading at 62,000. That's a big difference.
So there, I get it. So basically, the customers, the money's been frozen to a point where they didn't capture that upside. By the way, they'd probably be happy if that was the case, if Bitcoin went down. But that said, why aren't they capturing that upside? If they own tokens, why doesn't that just follow the path of Bitcoin?
Yeah, so it is important to note here that it actually is extremely rare to see creditors get more than pennies on the dollar in U.S. bankruptcy proceedings. So it's no small feat that the bankruptcy estate doubled the amount of money that Sam was convicted of stealing from customers. We're talking about $16 billion that they put together. But to your question, why aren't they getting more of this upside? I mean, FTX had an enormous stake in Solana, a token that's up 600% in the last year. It's got more than $1.1 billion of that token. And I think that it really goes to the point that this is a lot of accounting confusion. At the beginning, John Gray's team spent 6 months trying to figure out how much money was missing, and that's part of it. People don't know that it was necessarily just $8 billion of customer funds that were stolen.
Well, Mac, but you said it's not just the customers. I'm confused, okay? Because if you're recovering more money than was theoretically lost in the bankruptcy, the customers aren't getting it. Who's getting it? In my mind, somebody's getting rich off this if they, quote, I'm doing air quotes, found a couple billion bucks.
Yeah, and one thing I will also say is that there were some very smart venture investments. FTX just exited its stake in Anthropic, that AI startup. They more than doubled their money. But to your point, it's the lawyers and bankers who do tend to make a lot of money. As of January of this year, total legal fees based on the average monthly fee of the three law firms involved here was estimated at $260 million. And I can tell you who's getting absolutely nothing here are the equity shareholders, folks who actually held shares of ownership in the company itself. You mentioned Tom Brady, Steph Curry, Kevin O'Leary. FTX says that they're not getting a dime. That also includes Sequoia Capital, other like VC funds, and the Ontario Teachers Pension Plan. So a lot of people not seeing any upside if this bankruptcy plan is approved.
Oh, what a story. And I got to imagine old Sam Bankman-Fried sitting in prison for 25 years is thinking, wait a minute, all this happened. We've recovered more money than theoretically was stolen, and yet I'm in jail. I have a feeling we have not heard the last of this story. Mackenzie Sigalos, thank you very much.
Thanks, Brian.
It's like Warren Zevon said, send in the lawyers, guns, and money. All right, coming up, Robinhood investors cheering the company hitting a new major milestone. CEO Vlad Tenev will join us for a first on CNBC Interview next. All right, welcome back. Robinhood earnings, they are out right now, and that stock is popping. It's up about 3.5%. The company posting its second straight quarterly profit, fueled in part by a 232% jump in crypto transaction revenue, which accounted for $126 million in revenue in the quarter. But there's, as always, a lot more to the story. So let's just continue our West Coast jaunt and go up the coast to Kate Rooney, who is live at Robinhood's headquarters with the CEO, Vlad Tenev. I'm going to shut up and let you take it away, Kate. We'll see you in about 6 minutes. Kate Rooney.
Sully, thank you so much, Brian. Vlad, it's great to see you. Thank you so much for being here, having us here at Menlo Park.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
Yeah, so big earnings day. Brian mentioned it. Really strong crypto volume, but also net deposits. What was fueling that, and where was most of this money coming from?
Yeah, I mean, we were proud of this quarter because it really shows that the strategy is working. And if you remember, we're focused on three things: winning the active trader market, growing wallet share with our customers, and expanding internationally. So crypto was strong. We saw growth in equities and options market share as well, which rounded out the active trader investments we've been making. We also had the largest net deposits in the history of the company. So that's net cash and assets moving into Robinhood, of over $11 billion, which is the highest ever.
So where were they coming from? Was it crypto deposits? Were these deposits from, you mentioned other incumbent brokerage firms. Was this Robinhood stealing market share from Schwab and Fidelity?
It was, and it was actually well-diversified between asset transfers from other brokerages, mm-hmm. and that was in the range of $3 to $4 billion. But it was also quite strong in terms of just normal customers that were depositing from their bank accounts. So it wasn't any one thing that we can point to. Of course, crypto was strong, but I think across the board, the business is growing and we're just getting started.
Retirement accounts as well had a big quarter. Some of this was incentive. So you guys were offering 3% for people to essentially take their money and transfer it out of one of the incumbents. There was some chatter ahead of earnings that that might end. You know, once you stop paying people to move their money, people might not want to be moving their money to Robinhood. Is that something you're worried about? Do you anticipate those flows continuing after some of these incentives slow down?
Yeah, I mean, again, we do run promos and incentives. You mentioned the 3% IRA transfer match. So for customers that were transferring their assets from another brokerage, we were matching 3% on retirement accounts. And that ended. And now we're doing a 1% match on individual taxable mm-hmm. accounts. So those have been effective. And we've really been experimenting with those. But they only account for a minority of the net deposits that are coming into the platform. A lot of it is just strength of the existing user base, deposits predominantly coming from customers that have been on the platform for a year or more.
So I want to talk about crypto for a second. You saw really strong volume growth with crypto, but over the weekend, SEC, or you guys at least, disclosed as Wells notice from the SEC, essentially.
We did, yes.
Saying that Robinhood was offering unregistered securities. Feels like there's a bit of a disconnect. So you've got Gary Gensler on one side saying, just come on in and register. You, Coinbase, the other crypto trading platforms out there have said it's impossible. We're going to fight this. What is the disconnect? You're a stock brokerage firm. Why couldn't you just do the same thing you do with stocks, go in there, register everything, and call it a day?
It's not that easy. The existing securities laws and framework don't account for crypto assets. And there's a number of reasons why. The notion of a clearing agency and transfer agent and all sorts of details. But the upshot of it is we tried to create what's called a special purpose broker-dealer for the purpose of transacting in crypto assets. And we actually came in good faith to meet with the SEC. I think we met with them 16 times. And unfortunately, that was not reciprocated. And it was clear that there didn't seem to be a path. And so here we are.
You met with them 16 times and made no progress?
16 times. That's right.
What is that about?
It's hard to impute the reasoning behind that. But they told us they didn't want to keep meeting about it and they didn't see a path toward it. So definitely the SEC has the ability to change the rules to allow for brokers to accommodate crypto assets. And they don't seem intent on doing that. And rather, they're proceeding with regulation by enforcement. And that's disappointing. And I didn't want to have to get into this situation, but we have to defend ourselves and advocate for our customers. We do believe that crypto assets are becoming more and more important. And it would not be acceptable to us to not have Americans have access to them.
Aside from crypto, it is really interesting, and again, you are joining Coinbase sort of in that fight and Kraken and others. I want to pivot it for a second just to overall investor sentiment. What are you seeing in terms of flows, in terms of what the average investor is doing on Robinhood amid what looks like a higher for longer interest rate environment?
Yeah, I think that, at first when the interest rate environment went up, we saw sort of a decrease in trading activity. I think as yields went up and interest rates went up, stocks generally became less attractive relative to high yield savings and cash. And so we had to pivot the business and we launched Robinhood Gold with our high yield offering. And what we've seen in the past couple of quarters is the trading environment picked up. I think the investing public probably got accustomed to the high interest rate environment, and you saw that activity return. And our focus has been on diversifying the business, making sure that customers have access to a diverse set of products, because at the end of the day, what we want is for Robinhood to be the platform that can custody all of our customers' assets, handle all of their financial transactions. So we should do well and grow the business in all market environments. But yeah, market in an environment where trading is less prevalent, we look at market share. Even when trading was decreasing in 2023, our market share went up. So that tells us that we're making progress across all market environments.
Quick last question, $5 billion in cash, we could do buybacks or any M&A?
Well, in the past year, we've kind of done a combination. We acquired X1, right, which became the team that's powering our credit card. We bought back the Emergent Fidelity Technologies shares.
From FTX, notably.
So that was around 7% of the outstanding. And so I like having a strong balance sheet in this environment. I think it allows us to have flexibility. We have an active corp dev team that's evaluating opportunities, but we're also incredibly selective. You know, we want to have high confidence that it accelerates our roadmaps and is accretive to the roadmap and to shareholders. So we're not in a hurry to spend it. And I like having the flexibility there.
Vlad, great to see you. Thank you so much for having us. Vlad Tenev, CEO and co-founder of Robinhood. Brian, back over to you.
Thanks, all right, Kate and Vlad, thank you both very much. All right, by the way, before going public, Robinhood was a five-time CNBC Disruptor 50 company, atop the list in 2021. Now they're all billionaires. So who will top this year's list of private startups? Well, you got to find out on Tuesday when we reveal 12th annual list on air and online, cnbc.com/disruptors. But of course, just watch the show. All right, coming up, a worldwide withdrawal. AstraZeneca making a stunning move with its COVID vaccine. Some think the story should be getting a lot more attention than it is. We'll talk about it next. All right, welcome back. AstraZeneca announcing plans to withdraw its COVID vaccine worldwide because they said demand continues to decline. The pharmaceutical giant says, quote, as multiple variant COVID-19 vaccines have since been developed, there is a surplus of available updated vaccines. This has led to a decline in demand for the vaccine, which is no longer being manufactured or supplied. Despite the withdrawal, shares for AstraZeneca actually finished today slightly in the green. So what does this mean for the company and maybe the appetite for COVID vaccines at all? Let's bring in physician and NBC News contributor Dr. Kavita Patel. Now, in this release, Dr. Patel, they also said that there were some rare side effects around blood clots. Do you think that has anything to do with their decision to pull that vaccine, or was it just a business decision?
Yeah, Brian, probably a mixture of both. But look, let's go back to 2021 when AstraZeneca was one of the first vaccines out of the gates for the global economy and did $4 billion in business. And so they did 3 million doses. They were an incredible 3 billion doses, apologies. Lots and lots of doses from AstraZeneca, which was a part of that early effort when we had no vaccines. And then a lot of these side effects came up. This thrombosis, specifically blood clots that were significant, along with low platelet counts. It was the reason why the FDA asked for more information. And you notice we never did an emergency authorization for the AZ vaccine. We had our own vaccines here and a lot of them. So likely a decision based on both kind of business and a lot of these concerning side effects with so many other choices, Brian.
Yeah, and it's so critical what you're saying, Dr. Patel. The reality is they're being sued, a class action lawsuit in the UK, about 50 right. people, not a lot. But there is, and it's got to be clear, and maybe it's just a purely commercial decision, but to your point, the reality is that the company has acknowledged itself that on rare occasions, there are issues right. with blood clots and low blood platelets. I think this is a big story. Do you wonder if this will go to other vaccines, Dr. Patel? Because let's not forget where we were a couple of years ago.
Yeah, and I do think that the safety profiles of all the vaccines had been kind of called into question at some point over the last several years. You recall that there were kind of increased incidents of cardiac issues with younger adults, usually men and boys. So we know that there have been kind of side effects that have been reported. On the whole, though, especially for the mRNA vaccines that we use, as well as Novavax in the United States, that we have not seen any of the side effects to such significance that we need to pull the vaccines back. But Brian, I think you're right with the top line. This is a big deal. And I think it kind of underscores something that even I took for granted. You know, we were so interested in getting the vaccines out to people that we sometimes just did not do a good job communicating. Add to that these incidents, these side effects, these really concerning incidents like AstraZeneca's, and it's just undermined the public confidence. You wake up and you say, wait a minute, this thing causes blood clots? Well, what about these other vaccines? Who do I believe? And I think it just brings up, and we're about to talk about bird flu. Let me tell you, Brian, nobody wants to talk about another new set of vaccines for a possible pandemic, not even a starting conversation at this point.
Well, not right now, but we'll get you back on, Dr. Patel, because we want to talk about it, because we know we've been through. We know now that some of this stuff is coming out. I have no problem talking about bird flu, as uncomfortable as it is, because the truth matters. Dr. Kavita Patel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Folks, you know, it's a big story, AstraZeneca. All right, coming up, why Mercedes turning out the lights on one of its boldest goals yet. Stay with us. All right, welcome back. Time for another installment of Sully's Stats. There you go. Something that sticks out to us on the Last Call team. And tonight it features one of the biggest stock train wrecks out there. And that train wreck is a store you know. It's called Walgreens. Somehow it just keeps getting worse for America's biggest pharmaceutical chain. Walgreens has lost nearly half of investor value in just a year. It has wiped out 26 years of investor gains after slashing its dividend back in January. Just 9 years ago, Walgreens Boots Alliance, as it officially known, was a $97 stock with a market cap of $83 billion. Walgreens is now a $17 stock worth just $15 billion, and it's falling fast. Walgreens Boots Alliance, with over 8,000 stores in America, is certainly a stock and a story to watch. All right, well, another EV dream apparently biting the dust. Mercedes is further walking back its EV ambitions after realizing that they're just not boosting profit. Now, the luxury automaker originally planned to be fully electric. Remember that? A couple years ago, we're going to be fully electric by the end of this decade. But now that's looking like maybe something into the next decade or the next one after that, or maybe never. Even with its push into the EV market, Mercedes U.S. sales have been relatively flat over the last 5 years. Consumers maybe are tapped out or just not excited about the lineup. It's hard to feel excited maybe when compared to other iconic Mercedes models. But does the disconnect lie within EVs or maybe just the design of the cars themselves? With us tonight is Auto Trader Executive Editor Brian Moody. Brian, okay, people know my views, but when we talk about it with Mercedes and I post it online and some of the comments on X are pretty funny, I mean, $100,000 for some of these cars that look like they were smushed together.
Yeah, there is a bit of a similarity in how electric cars look and feel. I think the telling thing here is that if Mercedes-Benz electric cars aren't selling well, that's a problem because they are excellent electric vehicles. They're selling an experience more than just a car. So they do function well with lots of thoughtful features. I think what we're seeing is that a lot of early adopters already have the car they want, and now you have to appeal to everybody else, and they might not be ready to jump on the bandwagon. They might prefer hybrids instead because they use the existing system to refuel.
And not all the cars. You got the Rivian R1S, which I think is the best-looking electric SUV out there. But they look the same because they need that sloped back style for pure aerodynamics, I would imagine, Brian, to get that range.
Yes.
They got to get that range number over 300. So to your point, you got a $90,000 Mercedes, which looks like a $50,000 Kia. And I think that's probably more of your problem than how you're power planting the car, whether it's gas, wind, solar, whatever.
Yes. I think part of that is that if you lead with ideology, it ends you here. You need to lead with letting the market decide. The market will tell you where they want to be. And it's worth asking, where will our clean air goals and our climate goals be in 25 years if hybrids are getting 100 miles per gallon? I don't hear that conversation, and it's worth asking. Yeah. So maybe it's just too soon, even though the cars themselves are quite good.
We'll see what happens. I think the design, a big part of it, maybe BMW too. Brian Moody, really appreciate your views. Thank you. All right, folks, that is it for your last call tonight or this afternoon from LA. We're back here tomorrow. Shark Tank is next.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.